Men and elves leaned forward in anticipation, but Romo's words were addressed to Tungdil alone. "The dwarves of Beroin, Boringar, Giselbert, and Goimdil must leave these lands without delay. Once they're gone, the Thirdlings will save Girdlegard from the Avatars and send warriors to defend the gates of the other four kingdoms. Our folk is numerous and powerful." He smiled maliciously. "The children of Rakkas must decide whether Girdlegard shall be destroyed." Chapter 3. Purista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, late autumn, 6235th solar cycle.
"The Thirdlings are crafty,"
said Gandragar, looking into the worried faces of the other dwarven monarchs.
"It's not war they're after. They want to kick us out of Girdlegard by other means."
Boindil clenched his fists.
"I'd like to give Romo a taste of my axes."
"It wouldn't help," Tungdil reminded him.
"No, but it would make me feel better."
The warrior snorted impatiently.
"I'm angry enough to kill an army of runts and stamp on their plug-ugly."
"Shush," said Boindil. "Some of us are trying to think."
Gandragar and the rest of the dwarven delegation were seated at a table in one of the palace's many rooms. Laid out before them was a map of Girdlegard. Hours had passed since they started discussing what to do about Romo's proposal, and still no one had come up with a viable solution. They had until dusk to reach a decision, and the light was fading fast.
"Why didn't he want us there when he told them about the weapon?" asked Belindis.
At the sound of the smith's voice, Tungdil reached for Mir's hand as if to prove to himself that he loved her. He felt as if he were dangling over an open mineshaft with only Mir to stop his fall. Looking up, he saw that Belindis was holding hands with Glaimbar.
"I've moved on," he told himself firmly,
although he couldn't help thinking that Belindis looked pretty. His heart sped up a little.
"Because I'm agitated," he reasoned.
He was furious at the Thirdlings for exploiting Girdlegar's predicament for their own ends.
"I expect he was hoping to win over the elves and men before Namora had time to warn us," said the one-armed king of the Secondlings. "Neither he nor his uncle reckoned with Tungdil's appearance."
1-0 to the children of Rakkas,
commented Boindil confidently, running a hand through his sleek-looking beard. He had greased it with leftover fat from Mir's kitchen, and he didn't seem bothered by the residual smell of meat.
"It's not over yet,"
warned the High King, feeling the weight of his crown. He rested his chin on his hands.
"We underestimated Lorimbas. He's 100 times more dangerous than Bislipur. Unless you can come up with a better solution..."
He paused, looking hopefully at Belendalin, who was silent.
"In that case, Rakkas, forgive me, but I'll have to give the order for our kingdoms to be cleared."
"Never!"
protested
Boindil, smashing his fist against the table.
"If you banish us to the outer lands, the Thirdlings will steal our strongholds and..."
"Girdlegard will be saved,"
said Gandragar in a commanding voice.
"Boindil Doubleblade, I know how you feel. I don't want to give our strongholds to the Thirdlings either. But what of our Vrakas-given mission?"
He looked each of them in the eye.
"I want you to remember the smith's first commandment. Our duty is to protect the inhabitants of Girdlegard. If we're obliged to leave our kingdoms, so be it."
The High King's speech was followed by a long silence, as everyone searched for an alternative.
"Couldn't we attack the Thirdlings and seize the secret weapon?" suggested Queen Xantes.
Belendalin shook his head.
"The Black Range is uncharted territory. None of us could lead an army safely through the passageways and tunnels. There isn't time to plan an attack. even if the elves and the men were to help. Besides, Lorimvas would be ready for us, and some of his warriors are garrisoned at the Black Saddle. If we march on the Black Range, he'll attack us from behind.
Perfect timing on their part, observed Tungdil, leaning back in his chair. They probably think we've got no choice. He smirked.
What's this? Queried Gandagar, sitting up. Is Tungdil Goltan proposing another act of heroism?
Not exactly. I was thinking the Thirdlings could help us.
Boendal and Boendil exchanged glances, guessing what their friend had in mind. Belindis looked at them questioningly, and Boendil flashed her a confident smile. Tungdil stroked the coin-shaped patch of gold embedded in his hand. It shimmered in the light of the setting sun. I got to know the Freelings during my stay in their capital. Some are Thirdlings like me, and like me, they aren't possessed of Lorimbur's murderous hatred.
As he said the word hatred, his gaze settled briefly on Glaimbar.
They know their way around the Thirdling Kingdom, he finished, looking away.
I'm sure they'd be happy to help, agreed Mir. They could lead...
She trailed off, discouraged by the delegate's response. Everyone around the table was staring at her with open curiosity. She was a pale aberration, a dwarf without chainmail, whose smooth white skin was unlike anything in Vrakas's creation. It was true in some respects that she resembled Alabaster, but the comparison wasn't favorable. Alabaster was soft, crumbly, and practically useless. It had nothing in common with the granite from which the Founding Fathers had been hewn.
How can we be sure the Thirdlings in Trovegold are any better than Romo? Someone demanded grimly.
The others were thinking the same, but it was Belindis who voiced their concern.
Don't take it personally, Tungdil. Your loyalty is beyond question, but we know you. We can't trust Thirdlings whom we've never set eyes on.
What about Sander? She's the Queen Consort, he protested. Before he could continue, he was silenced by a kick from Mir. Given her distrust of the Freeling Commander, it seemed prudent to leave the matter there.
I know plenty of Thirdlings, volunteered the pale-skinned medic. I trust them with my life. She knew from their scornful looks that she was wasting her breath.
We can't stake our future on the dubious loyalties of Thirdlings, decided Gandagar, ruling against the proposal.
Your Majesty, the Thirdlings in Trovegold are an invaluable asset, ventured Belendalin, hoping to change the High King's mind. In his view, Tungdil's suggestion was their only hope.
With knowledgeable guides, we could launch a surprise attack.
Tungdil nodded gratefully at the one-armed secondling.
Gemmel's realm is vast, much bigger than I'd imagined. The number of Freeling cities defies belief.
He rose to his feet, knowing that the next words he uttered could change the dwarf's course.
The Freelings came to our aid and defended the Fifthling Kingdom against hordes of Orcish revenants. 2,000 warriors battled for our cause. It took King Gemmel a matter of orbits to send an army to the range.
Tungdil looked at Gandagar beseechingly.
They can help us, Your Majesty. They're a force to be reckoned with.
Gandagar bowed his head, closed his eyes, and covered his face with his hands. No one could tell whether he was praying or deep in thought. Silence descended on the chamber. Mir squeezed Tungdil's hand and smiled at him nervously. At last, Gandagar uncovered his face and sighed.
We're leaving,
he said evenly.
Boindil let out a shriek.
Leaving? We can't give up our kingdoms without a fight.
Are you sure, Your Majesty?
Persisted Belendalin.
We'll be leaving our strongholds in the midst of winter. What about the womenfolk and children? Our losses will run to hundreds before we encounter the first band of orcs.
What kind of future awaits us in the Outer Lands? Even the fog is dangerous.
I know, sighed Gandagar. I'm aware of the risks. I'm condemning our kinsfolk to a perilous march over icy passes and narrow ridges and treacherous winter snow. Believe me, Belendalin, I'll mourn the death of every dwarf. Fracas will hold me accountable.
His eyes welled with tears.
But our sacrifice won't be in vain. We'll leave in the knowledge that Gurdlegard is safe. Our kingdoms will still be standing when we return.
The Thirdlings won't relinquish our strongholds, objected Belindolin. It's war either way. If we fight them now, we might prevail, but later, the Thirdlings will wipe us out, Your Majesty. They'll ensconce themselves in our strongholds and bombard us with boiling pitch, boulders and arrows. We'll perish at the bottom of our own defences.
He leaned over the map and placed a finger on the black range.
Strike now and...
Gandagar rose to his feet, trembling with rage.
Enough! He bellowed. I'm the High King, and I've made my decision. We can't risk a war with the Thirdlings, do you hear? The Avatars are wily and powerful. They kill the Maegar, and they'll strike again. The decision stands. We're leaving Gurdlegard.
He raised the ceremonial hammer and brought it down so heavily that a crack appeared in the table.
Tungdil,
he said, his voice still etched with anger.
Go back to the conference chamber and tell Romo we accept the deal.
Tungdil got up, bowed, and left the room with Mir.
It's all wrong, he muttered to himself. I don't know why Gandagar thinks the Avatars are so wily. Why target Andokai when the Thirdlings are the threat?
What's the matter? Asked Mir. Do you think it's a mistake for the dwarves to leave? Tungdil stopped mid-stride, as if colliding with a wall. He turned to Mir and kissed her fervently. The satisfied expression on his face seemed at odds with his earlier despondency.
What's the matter?
She asked breathlessly, puzzled by the rush of affection.
I'll tell you later, he promised.
She waited outside while Rodario opened the door and ushered Tungdil to his chair. Romo had ordered a tankard of beer and was slurping noisily. His companion peered intently at Tungdil. A look of astonishment crossed his face, and he averted his eyes.
If it isn't King Gandogar's message, boy, exclaimed Romo with a malicious laugh.
He wiped his beard on the back of his sleeve.
Has the High King reached a decision?
Yes, replied Tungdil levelly. King Gandagar wishes it to be known that he agrees to the unscrupulous terms laid down by your uncle.
He heard gasps from the other delegates, some of whom seemed relieved, while others were clearly shocked and saddened that the dwarves were being blackmailed into giving up their kingdoms. Tungdil left his chair and, drawing himself up to his full height, stopped in front of Romo.
Know this, Romo Steelheart. If Gurdlegard falls, you and your uncle will die by my hand.
He threatened, tilting his axe toward him. Lorimbas's nephew saw at once that it would be foolish to provoke his challenger. To the astonishment of the delegates, Tungdil's threat met with something akin to respect.
Tell King Gandagar that his decision has been noted and will be conveyed to my uncle. Your fears about Gurdlegard's future are unfounded. Once the Thirdlings are in control of the ranges, nothing will breach our defences.
He took his morning star from the table.
We'll keep out the vermin, the Avatars, the beasts, and the Vrakas-loving dwarves.
He got up, hooked the weapon over his belt, and set off toward the doors, followed by his taciturn companion, who glanced over his shoulder at Tungdil. Romo stopped in the doorway,
The Thirdling annexation of the Dwarven Kingdoms begins in 80 orbits. After that time, any dwarves in our ranges will be killed.
He cast a roll of parchment to the floor.
Here's a list of chattels. The items in question must be left at our disposal. Tell Gandogar we'll deal with his kingdom first.
The delegates watched as the sturdy figures receded into the distance, their unwieldy armor echoing through the shadowy corridors long after they disappeared from view. Led by Gandogar, the dwarves rejoined the discussions as soon as Rodario brought word that Romo and his companion had left the chamber.
"These are dark times for Gerdlegard," said Malin, stepping forward to shake hands with the dwarves. "We're saving our kingdoms and losing the dwarves. It's a high price to pay. Perhaps we should fight the Thirdlings instead."
"No," replied Gandogar firmly. "We can't waste precious time. The dwarves will return when the danger is over."
"You can count on our support," promised Malin.
There were no words to express his gratitude, so he inclined his head respectfully instead.
"If the Thirdlings break their promise, you won't be the only one after their blood," said Lutisil to Tungdil. "We'll kill them faster than it takes 11 demigods to burn Satalia's forests. If the Thirdlings have deceived us, the elves will make them pay."
He turned to Gandogar. "From now on, the selfless dwarves and their noble High King will be immortalized in our songs. No one in Alandor will speak ill of the four dwarven folks who sacrificed their kingdoms for our safety." The Lord of the Elves bowed before the dwarf of all dwarfs, showing their deference. One by one, the monarchs followed his example and bowed before leaving the room.
"I'll accompany Romo in person and find out the truth about their weapon," said Namora, preparing to leave. "If they've lied, they'll have an angry Maegar to deal with, as well as a dwarven hero and an elven lord. Gandogar and the other monarchs can take care of the survivors."
Signalling for Rodario to follow her, she withdrew to her wing of the palace. The deputations from the dwarven kingdoms took their leave. Most were hoping to drown their sorrows in beer and mead. At last, only Tungdil, the twins, and Belindis were left. Boindil remembered something that had been puzzling him.
"Belindis, how did you know it wasn't Jerun?"
"I never forget a piece of metalwork," she said, smiling. "Especially not a suit of armor like that. The etchings and engravings on the breastplate weren't my work. They were passable imitations, but nothing more."
Her face fell.
"Unfortunately, I didn't spot the forgery in time."
She stepped forward and gave Tungdil a tentative embrace.
"May Vrakas bless your melding with a warm hearth and a casket of gold," she said in a strained voice. "We won't see each other for a while, I suppose."
Closing his eyes, he filled his nostrils with her scent. He hadn't missed it until now, but it was so familiar, so precious. He knew it was the last time he would hold her in his arms.
"I still love her," he thought forlornly, clasping her to him and pressing his lips against her brow. "Vrakas be with you," he murmured, too choked to say anything else.
For Belindis, it came as a shock to see the truth in his eyes, and Tungdil was startled to see the tenderness and sorrow in her face. She still loved him. She loved him in spite of the way he had shunned her. He reached for her hand, but she took a step back and shook her head.
"Glaimbar is waiting,"
she said in a smothered voice, turning away. He watched her go, remembering all the other goodbyes. Too many goodbyes.
"Mir is waiting too," he whispered.
"We're still here, you know, scholar,"
said Boindil, with his usual lack of tact. He looked at him intently.
"You and Mir should join our deputation. How about it?"
Boindil suspected that their friend had other plans. He was sure he had seen a hint of a smile playing on Tungdil's lips
Have you thought of a way to foil the Thirdlings?
Maybe, said Tungdil cagily, laying a hand on Boendal's shoulder. I haven't quite conquered my doubts, but I'll come straight to you and Boindil when I'm ready.
Boendal grinned.
I knew you weren't destined to spend your orbits in an armchair. Fracas has sent a spark of heroism to relight your fires. Whatever you're planning, count us in. We'll storm the Black Range if we have to.
He set off with his brother in the direction taken by Belindis. Tungdil wandered through the palace, vacillating between confidence and doubt. Soon he was hopelessly lost, but he kept walking deep in thought. Belindis's farewell was playing on his mind. His wounds from their separation were as painful as ever. He realized now that scarring wasn't the same as healing, and even Mir was a salve, not a cure. She took his mind off the pain, but she couldn't make it go away. It wasn't that he didn't love her. He just loved the smith more.
How can you think about Belindis when the future of Girdlegard is at stake?
He shivered at the thought of the decision he had to make.
Fracas, give me wisdom.
It took a while for him to regain his bearings among the endless passageways and chambers of the palace. At last he found himself outside the conference chamber. Striding past an archway, he noticed three short figures at the end of a shadowy corridor. One was small and dainty, the next was broad-shouldered, and the third was noticeably taller and larger.
That sounds like Mir.
Tungdil stopped in his tracks and hurried back to the corridor.
Hello, Mir, he called cheerfully. Don't tell me you got lost as well.
The smallest of the three figures gave the biggest dwarf a shove. Tungdil heard a muffled shriek, followed by a clatter of weaponry and a sickening thud. His warrior's spirit ignited. Whipping out his axe, he sprinted down the corridor and threw himself between the dainty freeling and the other dwarfs.
Back off,
he said menacingly, noticing the gashes in Mir's left cheek. Blood was streaming down her face, streaking her pale complexion.
Now it's personal.
Romo, holding two thick tomes in one hand, reached for his morning star with the other. His gauntlet shimmered red with Mir's blood.
Lorimbar be praised, he spat. Not everyone has the privilege of killing Girdlegard's favorite dwarf.
He threw the books to his companion.
Take these, Salfalor. My uncle can't wait to read them.
Salfalor, the dwarf who killed my parents.
Tungdil stared at the powerful dwarf who caught the books and turned to flee. The tattoos made his ferocious features look doubly sinister, almost demonic.
No!
Shrieked Mir, pulling a dagger from her belt. She launched herself at the brawny thirdling.
Give me back my work!
Salfalor waited unflinchingly for the dagger to thud against his chainmail. The tip broke off. Raising an armored fist, he punched the little dwarf's wounded face. Mir flew back as if struck by Vrakus's hammer, hit the wall and slumped to the ground.
Come on, Romo, commanded Salfalor. We're leaving before the Maegar and her Famulus catch up with us.
Romo roared with laughter. The chains of his morning star whirred menacingly, the spiked balls circling above his head.
And let the scumbag live. I've never spared a child of Vrakus, and I won't start now.
At last, Tungdil shook off the paralysis induced by finding Salfalor and seeing Mir hurt. He saw the morning star coming and ducked.
You've killed your last dwarf, Romo Steelheart, he growled, ramming the sharp end of his axe into the thirdling's thigh.
He drew the weapon back and used the momentum to lunge at him with the blade. Cursing, Romo dodged the blow and hobbled backward. Features distorted by hatred and rage, he stared at his bleeding thigh.
Die, you traitor! He thundered.
taking the Morning Star in both hands and swinging it at Tungdil again and again. Tungdil knew that the haft of his axe, albeit reinforced with steel, was no match for the Morning Star. Rather than risk losing his only weapon, he focused on staying out of reach. The metal balls cannoned into the walls of the passageway, sending shards of marble flying through the air, but Romo's assault continued unabated. Cursing and panting, he pursued his adversary with relentless zeal. Stepping backward, Tungdil stumbled over Mir and was punished for his carelessness by a terrible blow. One of the steel balls crashed into his arm while another collided with his broken ribs. Bent double with agony, he focused his energy on keeping hold of his axe.
"How many blows to fell a hero?"
jeered Romo, circling the Morning Star above his head and preparing to strike.
"Two at the most, I'll warrant."
The balls spun toward him. Tungdil reached up and deflected them with his axe head. They hit a door and crashed through the timber. One of the chains got stuck in the wood and refused to yield to Romo's increasingly vigorous efforts to pull it free.
"How many strikes to fell a thirdling?"
said Tungdil, dealing a one-handed blow to Romo's torso. The blade cut through his chainmail and buried itself in his flesh. Blood spurted from the wound. Romo had no intention of conceding defeat. Abandoning his Morning Star, he thrust both gauntlets simultaneously into Tungdil's face. Tungdil tumbled to the ground. His eyelids swelled, narrowing his vision, and blood trickled from a gash above his right eye. Romo pulled the axe from his torso and held it aloft.
"More than you think,"
he thundered, preparing to strike. Harsh yellow light filled the corridor.
"Take that!"
shouted a melodramatic voice behind Tungdil. He felt a rush of hot air as flames shot toward Romo, turning him into a living torch. The thirdling's beard was ablaze and his skin was charred and cracked. A nauseating smell of burning flesh filled the air. Romo made no attempt to extinguish the flames. He took another step toward Tungdil and raised his arm to strike. Just then, a figure cannoned into him from behind, and his axe careered sideways. The blade embedded itself in the floor, half a hand away from Tungdil's chest. Growling, Romo shook off his assailant.
"Huzzah!"
shouted Ironheart, leaping up and brandishing his axes.
"Come here so I can give you a taste of my blades."
"Stop!"
called Tungdil. He clambered to his feet and pulled the Morning Star from the ruins of the door.
"He's mine."
Romo parried the first blow, but Tungdil struck again, and the metal balls slammed into the thirdling's head, neck, and throat. He wobbled, but didn't fall. Tungdil landed three hefty strokes in succession until at last Lorimbas's nephew lay motionless on the floor.
"I never wanted to be a dwarf killer," thought Tungdil, dropping the Morning Star onto his enemy's body. "But Romo deserved to die."
"That was no fun," complained Ironheart. "He'd been burned to a cinder and injured already. Where's the challenge in that?"
He glanced around eagerly.
"What happened to the chunky one? He'll put up a better fight."
Meanwhile, his brother, assisted by Tungdil and Radario, still glowing from his debut as a Femulus, was attending to Mir. Tungdil, ignoring his own wounds, scooped the unconscious Freeling off the cold flagstones and carried her back to their chamber, where he tended to her until Namora took charge. In short order, the Maegar restored the dwarf to her former condition, allowing her skin to grow back as smooth as ever, with no evidence of damage to the silvery down on her cheeks. Next, Namora turned her healing energies to Tungdil and mended his broken ribs. Lifting his arms gingerly, he discovered that the pain was gone.
"Magic gives me goosebumps," he said.
"All magic?
or just Samusin's magic? The Maegar inquired. You pray to Samusin, said Tungdil, surprised. I was born of an elf. The other gods won't have me. Listen, Tungdil, there's no need to worry about Mir. She's sound asleep, and she won't wake before morning. You may as well look for the missing thirdling.
Salfalor, he said grimly, picking up his axe and hurrying over to the twins who were hovering in the doorway with the impresario. Thank you for your help back there, he said to Rodario. Can you tell us the fastest route out of Perista?
My dear dwarf, I built this city, bragged Rodario. Well, I oversaw the building of it, he appended, edging closer to the truth. Fergus drafted the plans.
Boindil frowned.
So, you're more a caretaker than an architect. I know this city like the back of my hand.
He tugged on his sleeve to hide the miniature tinderbox, a sophisticated device that threw flames at the tug of a cord. Several dwarves and humans had witnessed his fiery attack on Romo and were convinced of his magic powers.
Still doing party tricks? Laughed Boendal. You're supposed to be a Fimulis, not a street magician. It worked, didn't it?
The impresario retorted touchily.
You wait. Women will love it. I've got everything. Thespian charm, writerly eloquence, natural good looks, and now mastery of the mystic arts.
Boindil roared with laughter.
Not to mention the wandering eye of a philanderer.
Come on, said Tungdil, smiling in spite of himself. We don't have time for your nonsense, Rodario.
My nonsense? I'd ever been so...
He saw the determined look on Tungdil's face, and set off through the labyrinthine corridors of the palace with the dwarves in his wake. The city wasn't destined to sleep that night. Every street, every house, every chamber was searched by patrols of men, elves and dwarfs, but there was no sign of Salfalor. The Thirdling had vanished, and with him Mir's notes about Trovegold and the other cities. Soon, Lorimbas would know every detail about Gemmell's secret realm. Perista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, late autumn, 6235th solar cycle. Tungdil was sitting at Mir's bedside when she woke with a start. The delicate dwarf took a few moments to remember what had happened.
Did you stop them?
She asked weakly. He shook his head. We couldn't find Salfalor. He disappeared.
We've got to warn Gemmell. The Thirdlings will know everything about our realm.
She looked up at the ceiling and thumped the wall.
If only I hadn't brought the books with me. I never thought my penny-pinching could cause such trouble. What if Lorimbas invades?
Your penny-pinching?
I only brought the books with me because I wanted to fill the empty pages. I knew I'd have lots to write about, and paper is expensive. It's my duty as a scholar to chronicle everything I see and hear. I'm the eyes and ears of Trovegold. I can't allow our history to be forgotten.
She ran a hand tentatively over her forehead, remembering her encounter with the wall.
Warriors never leave home without their weapons. I never go anywhere without my books.
He stroked her smooth cheeks. Belatedly, she realized that she wasn't in any pain. She raised a hand to her face.
You won't find a scar, Tungdil told her with a smile. Namora is a Maegar. She healed my ribs as well.
A Maegar? Echoed Mir, impressed.
She lay still for a moment and closed her eyes. She seemed to be searching for evidence, an inner voice, a hidden clue that might reveal the workings of the Maegar's power.
I've read about magic, she said a little sheepishly. I thought maybe you could feel it.
It's strange, isn't it?
He agreed with a grin.
There's something odd about magic. It doesn't suit us dwarves.
He was glad to see that Mir had made a full recovery. It seemed to confirm that he had made the right decision about melding his heart to hers. Just because he loved Belindis didn't mean he wasn't genuinely fond of Mir. They were soulmates, brought together by their love of learning. As soon as he taught her to appreciate metalwork, they would make a perfect pair.
Except you still love Belindis, his inner demon reminded him slyly.
Tungdil responded by leaning over and kissing Mir.
Nice try, laughed the demon.
Mir smiled uncertainly.
It was horrible, Tungdil.
I found the Thirdlings in our chamber, rummaging through my things.
Romo, I think that's what he said his name was, bashed me on the head and knocked me out. The next I knew, I was dangling from his shoulder.
He threatened to kill me if I made a noise.
Thank Vrakas you came along and saved me.
It was nothing, he said modestly. Anyway, I probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for your skill as a surgeon. Remember how we met? I had an elvish arrow in my shoulder and another in my chest. You pulled them out and healed me.
He paused and looked at her gravely. As soon as you're well enough, we'll be on our way. Meanwhile, there's something I need to deal with. I've asked for an audience with Gandogar.
With Gandogar? Why? She tried to sit up in bed but slumped sideways against his shoulder.
It's all right. I think I'm still dizzy from being bashed on the head or colliding with the wall, or both.
He held on to her. You'll probably say I'm crazy. But I think it's a cunning ploy.
She looked at him startled. What's a ploy?
I think the Thirdlings don't know anything about the Avatars, he explained. If you ask me, they know we're running scared. They're taking advantage of the situation. This could be their ultimate victory. It's safer and more effective than a war. One in two of our kinsmen will die on the march to the Outer Lands. The paths are treacherous. It's deepest winter, and we'll have avalanches to contend with.
Not to mention hunger, she said sadly.
The Thirdlings' demands are designed purely to kill the maximum number of dwarves. They're trying to trick us into leaving Girdlegard by spinning us a story about a secret weapon.
He looked into her red eyes. The Thirdlings are lying, and I can prove it.
From what Boendal told me about the first meeting, Romo didn't say anything about the Avatars, only about a threat from the west. He was stringing us along.
If I were Gandagar, I'd want better evidence than that, objected Mir.
What if Romo was referring to the Avatars when he...
Maybe he was, cut in Tungdil. The question is, why would the Avatars kill Andukai if Lorimbas were the threat?
He smiled. First, Romo was talking about stopping them. Next, he was going to destroy them.
Which is it?
Stopping, destroying? It's the same to a warrior like him. He wasn't the sort to care about distinctions.
That's not all, though. He couldn't give any details about the weapon. No wonder. It doesn't exist.
What if the secret to stopping the Avatars is so straightforward that he'd be giving away their bargaining power? Or maybe he likes being awkward.
He could have told us something, like whether it's an axe or a trebuchet or runes to be carved above the western gates, insisted Tungdil, who felt like he was arguing his case before a judge. It seemed to him that Mir was being deliberately contrary.
You're right to distrust him. But think how the Dwarven Monarchs will react. He's promising to save Girdlegard, and you're saying we can't be helped.
Why would they believe Romo? He hasn't given them any proof, said Tungdil moodily.
He thought for a moment.
You're right, though. Sometimes the truth isn't welcome. If I were Gandagar, I'd give Romo the benefit of the doubt. Imagine what it would be like watching Girdlegard go up in flames and knowing that you could have saved it. I wouldn't want to live with the guilt.
You'd rather send thousands of dwarves to their deaths?
Come on, Mir. You can't agree to the banishment of the folks when there's a good chance the Thirdlings are lying. Even if we make it back to Girdlegard, we'll have to fight or trick our way into our kingdoms. Meanwhile, Lorimbas and the Thirdlings will be laughing themselves Vrakasium red.
He stood up. I know you don't agree with me, but it's my duty to alert the High King to a possible plot.
You need more evidence, ruled Mir. You haven't persuaded me.
She pressed her lips to his hand.
Vrakas be with you.
We appreciate you sharing your suspicions, began Gandogar.
Tungdil knew at once what the High King was going to say. Mir was right, he thought.
I need more proof.
He didn't bother to listen to the rest of the speech. Gandogar's objections were much the same as Mir's. He glanced at the other delegates. King Belendalin, King Glaimbar, and Queen Zamtis looked worried and dismayed.
They must be wondering how to break the news to their clansfolk.
How do you explain that the High King wants everyone to leave their kingdoms and risk their lives for a weapon that might not exist? He bowed and took a seat, even though Gandogar was still speaking. The dwarf of all dwarfs didn't seem offended by his rudeness.
I'll go down as the worst High King in history, I know, but I've been left with no choice. Vrakas commanded us to give our lives for the safety of Gerdlegard.
He stood up.
It's settled. The dwarfs will leave their kingdoms. Tungdil, you'll have to tell Gemmel to abandon his realm. Now that the Thirdlings know the location of the underground cities, they're bound to attack.
He raised his hand in parting and left the chamber. The other delegates followed his lead. Tungdil covered his face with his hands. He couldn't bear to think about the hardships awaiting his kin. The footsteps died away, and the chamber was still. It didn't occur to him that anyone was left, so he was startled when a hand squeezed his shoulder. Uncovering his eyes, he turned and looked into Bowen Dahl's bearded face.
You mustn't give up, scholar.
He stepped aside, revealing a small band of dwarves looking grimly determined.
Not everyone thinks you're wrong. The kings and queens chose not to heed you, but your efforts weren't in vain. We saw the strength of your conviction, and we believe you.
One by one, the delegates introduced themselves. Between them, they represented all four folks.
Well, said Boindil expectantly, I hope there are enough of us. I'm assuming you've got a plan.
I had a plan, he said, thanking Vrakas for his small band of followers. A smile spread across his face. But I've thought of a better one.
One of the delegates cleared his throat.
I won't do anything to hurt my king, my clansfolk, or my family.
You're an honorable dwarf.
He scanned their faces. I'd sooner chop off my head than put any of our kinsfolk in danger. He beckoned them closer.
But I do have a mission for you. With your courage and Vrakas's blessing... He'll bless us all right, said Boindil confidently. In that case, the Thirdlings are in for a shock.
And he told them what he had in mind. Namora leaped out of bed, rushed down the corridor, and ran into Fergus's room. A moment later, Rodario was by her side.
Did you hear him scream?
Fetch Mir, she said tersely. She'll know what's wrong.
Rodario hurried away.
It's happening too soon, thought Namora distractedly. I don't know how to cure him yet.
She wiped the sweat from Fergus's face. A pink blotch appeared on the cloth. Thin lines of blood were trickling from Fergus's closed eyelids and mingling with his sweat.
I don't know how to counteract the poison. I need more time.
She waited impatiently for Mir, who turned up a few minutes later with Tungdil. Mir examined her patient thoroughly, listening to his heartbeat, checking his breathing and smelling his skin, before inspecting the contents of the chamber pot.
He's feverish, she announced, looking up at Namora.
All the symptoms point to poisoning.
He's in a bad way, estimable Mega.
His heart is gathering speed like a runaway trip hammer.
He'll die if you don't slow it down.
The Mega shivered.
I've been working on a charm, but I was wondering if you could give him something to ease the pain.
Mia raised her eyebrows.
You can't cure his symptoms with your magic? The toxin must be awfully strong.
Can you help him or not? Demanded Nomura, more sharply than intended.
You said we need to slow his heart.
I can't do anything without knowing the makeup of the poison, she said sadly.
His life is in your hands.
She packed her things and waited uncertainly next to Tungdil, until the Maga dismissed them with a nod. As soon as they were gone, Namora slipped her hand beneath her bodice and pulled out the shard of malachite, running her finger over its surface and sloughing off the dried blood.
It's the only way.
She washed the gem quickly, opened her bodice and focused her mind, channeling her magic energy into the malachite. The stone began to glow, becoming warmer against her skin.
Samusin, keep me from harm and save Fergus from suffering.
She placed the tip of the stone on the pale skin below her sternum and tensed her muscles, preparing, as Nudine had done before her, to absorb the Malachite's power.
Take my life if you have to, Samusin, but let him live.
She closed her eyes and drove the Malachite into her chest. The pain was unbearable. A viridescent sun exploded within her, dousing her in a caustic tide that seared, froze and swelled her veins, gathering inside her until she was sure she would burst like a rotten fruit. Suddenly it stopped. Namora fell to her knees and retched. A puddle of green vomit collected on the floor. The next wave of nausea purged her stomach of its contents, the stinking torrent of malachite vomit narrowly missing Fergus's bed.
Who are you? Called a voice.
She retched again, raising herself on trembling arms, and turned her head, looking for the speaker.
Is someone there? She gasped. I can teach you things that will make you more powerful than any Maga or Magus in history, the voice whispered.
Nudine appeared in the corner of the room. He smiled at her warmly. His robes belonged to another long-forgotten era.
You can't be! We killed you at the Black Saddle!
I'd like to help you, he said, morphing suddenly into the familiar bloated figure of Nodon. His smile became a smirk.
All Girdlygard will cower in awe of you, he promised.
The air above Fergus's bed seemed to shimmer, bringing forth the misty demon that Tungdil had slain at the Black Saddle.
Poor soul, he's dying, whispered the mist, caressing Fergus's cheeks. You can save him. I've given you the power.
Namora was dazzled by a bright green light. She closed her eyes, and when she opened them again, the mist was gone, and the room was silent, except for Fergus's muffled groans.
I must have imagined it.
She looked down to see that the wound had closed, without leaving a scar or a telltale malachite glow. The skin was flawless, and a single droplet of crimson blood marked the place where the stone had entered her breast. Fergus cried out in agony, his body convulsing with pain.
I'm here,
she said weakly, clutching the bed and stumbling to her feet. She laid a hand on his dressings.
Now we'll see the extent of my powers.
In a clear voice, she uttered the first of many incantations, taking her time over the syllables that came unbidden to her lips as she commanded the poison to leave Fergus's body. At once she heard a hissing noise. Sulphur yellow vapor rose from the motionless body and melted into the air. Meanwhile, tiny yellow droplets appeared on Fergus's skin, dancing like spilt water on a stove. Soon the sheets were drenched in yellow. Fergus's chest was rising and falling rapidly. He started to moan.
Am I killing him?
Thought Namora in alarm, starting to lift her hand.
Keep going, commanded a voice beside her. You have the power to cure him, Namora.
His eyes will open, you'll see.
Nodon smiled at her encouragingly.
Trust in me and the power of the stone. You're a Maega. He's in good hands.
Namora could see him clearly now. He bore no trace of the wounds inflicted at the Black Saddle.
You're an illusion, she said firmly. Be gone!
Nodon pointed to Fergus's stained bandages.
You've got to keep going, he told her.
Namora turned her attention back to Fergus. Strange words of healing surfaced in her memory, and she continued her incantations. Poison was still seeping from Fergus's pores, but suddenly he stopped groaning, drew a sharp intake of breath, and lay still.
No!
Cried Namora despairingly, rushing to the head of the bed and stroking his face. What have I done? Fergus opened his eyes and looked at the ceiling in surprise. At last he noticed Namora and raised a hand to her face.
Namora!
She swallowed, then threw her arms around him, laughing and crying. Fergus sat up and clasped her tightly.
You're back, she sobbed happily. Thank Samusin, you're back.
Fergus seemed bewildered by the outburst of affection, but enjoyed it all the same.
I remember now, he said slowly. We were attacked. What happened after that?
He kissed her shiny black hair and took her head in his hands so he could look at her properly. His gaze fell on her slender waist.
How long have I been asleep?
He asked, startled.
Stay there.
It's time you met your daughter, said Namora, racing off to fetch Dorsa. She handed the baby gently to Fergus, who was weeping with joy.
She had a brother, but he didn't live, she said.
Her eyes glistened as she recounted the events leading up to the accident that killed their child. Fergus stroked his daughter.
At least we've got Dorsa, he said gruffly,
kissing her tiny head.
He pulled Namora to him.
I love you, Namora. I love you both. After the orbits of torment, this moment is all the more precious.
Namora gave him a lingering kiss.
Get some sleep, my darling. Everything else can wait until the morning. I'm afraid there's a long road ahead if our family is to live happily in Perista. We'll need my talents and your technical wizardry.
She snuggled closer, holding her breath for a second as Nodon appeared at the end of the room. The apparition faded away.
Kingdom of John Balsur, Gerdlegard, late autumn, 6235th solar cycle. Hoship was sitting atop the largest mangonel, banging nails into the sturdy timber and wrapping rope around the framework to absorb the impact of the throwing arm. All around him, carpenters were at work in their lofty perches, twisting rope, adjusting leather buffers, and hammering nails into wood. On the ground, others were chopping and planing raw timber to make beams and struts for the next consignment of mangonels. Many orbits had passed since the Alphar burned down the siege engines. The nighttime raid had led to huge losses for the Allies, not to mention a standoff between the elves and the dwarves, but the biggest casualty was morale. The savagery of the Alphar's attack had dented confidence in an Allied victory, prompting mass desertions. Many of Hoship's fellow workers had abandoned their posts. Hoship had been tempted to join them, but the money was too good. Under normal circumstances, he wouldn't have ventured within 100 miles of John Balsur. But the army had secured his services with the promise of gold. He had already been paid more than he earned in an average cycle. He looked across at the swath of scorched earth, bordered on both sides by gloomy forest. From his vantage point, he could see that the Allies were barely a mile from the plains. Soon the army would be able to advance unhindered. Beyond the forest, the stronghold of Arvieux blotted the landscape like a malignant cyst,
its dark walls casting a shadow across the verdant plains. To cheer himself up, he imagined what John Balser would look like when the Alfar were gone. Beautiful, he thought, his spirits lifting a little. From the stronghold, the grassy plains extended for miles, dipping on the horizon to form a crater, from which rose a tapering tower, shimmering bone-white in the sun. This, then, was the heart of the Alvish kingdom, the target of the Allied campaign. Hoship picked up his hammer and returned to work.
"I wouldn't want to be a soldier," he thought with a shiver. "This is close enough for me."
Hours later, he was still clambering over the enormous mangonel, but the gathering gloom brought an end to the orbit's work. He began to climb down carefully. Without a rope to hold on to, or a net to catch him, the slightest clumsiness could see him falling 10 paces to the ground. Down below, the latest recruits had arrived, and fires were being lit. The soldiers had dug a moat around the camp, filled it with rags dipped in pitch and tar, and set light to the mix. Any elf that tried to breach the ring of fire was liable to burn to death. The order had been given for more pitch and tar to be added every hour. The foul-smelling concoction had been mixed to a sticky gloop to ensure it served its purpose rather than leaching into the soil. No one minded the stench or the acrid smoke. It was better than dying at the hands of the Alfar. Hoship was in good spirits. The siege engines would soon be back in action, reaching toward the stronghold of Arvieux with their powerful arms. Barrels of oil and petroleum were arriving from the human kingdoms, and in 10 orbits, the army would have sufficient fuel to finish the campaign. All in all, the Allies were in an excellent position. But fear, superstition, and rumour prevailed.
"Time for some hot grub and a tankard of ale."
After a solid orbit's labour, Hoship was looking forward to his bed of fresh hay. He jumped onto the mangonel's throwing arm and started to walk carefully to the ground. His eyes were drawn to the ring of fire around the camp. The flames were cowering fearfully at the bottom of the ditch. He stopped in his tracks. Every light in the camp was burning low. The campfires were dying, the candles on the makeshift tables were sputtering, and the oil lamp above the commander's tent was barely alight. A moment later, the camp was plunged into darkness. Hoship listened to the silence. Everyone was waiting and praying for the moment to pass. Every light had retreated, including the moon and stars.
"I've never seen it so dark."
It seemed to Hoship that the camp had been dunked in black ink, making it impossible to see further than his nose. The horses flared their nostrils and tried to break free. Whinnying in terror, they strained against their hitching posts, pulling until the wooden stakes jerked out of the ground. Hoship heard the sound of splintering timber, then thousands of hooves stampeded through the camp, trampling tents and soldiers. The spooked horses could see no better than the men, but their nostrils told them to run. Hoship clung to the arms of the mangonel as the fleeing herd collided with the frame. Great clouds of dust rose from the churned-up ground, mixed in with coal cinder from the fires. At last the deafening stampede was over, and the whinnying faded. The horses were out of the camp.
"Get in formation!"
commanded an officer, apparently undaunted. He had to shout to be heard above the welter of screams and shouts.
"Third company to me! Pikemen at the front!"
An armoured body hit the ground. The soldiers didn't need eyes to know what had happened.
"Run!"
shouted someone. A weapon clattered to the ground and footsteps raced away.
"They're here! They're in the camp!"
Hoship pressed himself against the mangonel, lying flat against the throwing arm between the uprights of the frame. If the darkness were to lift, he wanted as little as possible of his profile to be visible from the ground. Death descended on the camp. It started with a single drawn-out scream of agony.